It's 21.
Hi there, everyone. Welcome back to Hits 21, where me, Rob,
me, Andy,
and me, Livy,
all look back at every single UK number one of the 21st century, from January 2000 right through to the present day. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us over on Twitter. We are at Hits21UK, that is at Hits21UK, and you can email us too. Send it on over to Hits21podcast@gmail.com. Thank you ever so much for joining us again. We are currently looking back at the year 2008. We've been flying through this year, halfway through the year almost, after just two episodes, but this week we'll be covering the period between the 8th of June and the 5th of July. Looking back to last week, the poll winner, a little bit of a surprise at Hits21 HQ, was 4 minutes. Madonna, Justin Timberlake and Timbaland. And it wasn't that close, to be honest.
Yeah, 4 minutes surprise.
Was a fairly clear winner. So, yeah, well done to 4 minutes. Very interesting. It is time to press on with this week's episode. And as always, it's time for some news headlines from around the time the songs we're covering in this episode were at number one in the UK. Within the space of 8 days, both Gretna Football Club and Halifax Town both go out of business after existing for 62 years and 97 years, respectively. Phoenix club Gretna 2008 took over Gretna FC Stadium and now compete in the Lowland Leagues in Scotland, while FC Halifax Town formed around the same time and they're currently in the National League.
Shadow Home Secretary David Davis resigns as an MP over the government's plans to detain terrorists for up to 42 days. Meanwhile, Labour fall 20 points behind the Conservatives in the polls, with opposition leader David Cameron declaring the end of New Labour after a run of tough local by-election losses for Gordon Brown's government.
And construction begins on the Olympic Stadium, which is to be built for the 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games in London. The 80,000 all-seater stadium cost almost £500 million to build, although the final cost was closer to £1 billion, adjusted for inflation. It was later renamed the London Stadium, and its capacity was reduced to 60,000 when it became the home of West Ham Football Club.
The films to hit the top of the UK box office during this period were as follows. The Incredible Hulk for 2 weeks, The Chronicles of Narnia, Prince Caspian for 1 week, and Hancock for 1 week. In more football news, Spain win Euro 2008, beating Germany 1-0 in the final to secure the country's first major trophy since 1964. England didn't qualify for that tournament. And something we couldn't fit into the last episode but couldn't ignore, The Inbetweeners gets going on E4.
Meanwhile, Noel Gallagher hits out after Jay-Z is announced as one of the main Glastonbury headliners, saying he was not having hip-hop at the festival. In response, Jay-Z started his set by singing Wonderwall in front of a crowd of almost 100,000 people. Good move, that. I mean, what a knobhead.
Shut up, really? Splat.
I know, just fucking hell. Sorry for the language, but really, what a wazzick. Good move from Jay-Z there. Really like that. And Madonna files for divorce from Guy Ritchie, ending 8 years of marriage.
And American comedian Joan Rivers is asked to leave the studio during an episode of Loose Women after swearing live on air. After referring to actor Russell Crowe as, quote, a fucking shit, Joan later admitted to thinking the broadcast was delayed and that her comments would be bleeped out. ITV later revealed that it had received 50 complaints from viewers.
Really?
Well, at least he didn't have to put out a grovelling apology to Ofcom like they did for the Britain's Got Talent 2008 finals.
I just think, I really wonder about the mentality of these people who complain about hearing a swear word. Like, come on, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world. I'm sure people have got their reasons, but I don't know what they are.
Yeah.
Andy, how are the fucking album charts doing?
Well, Rob, you knobhead. So, obviously, the last couple of weeks, because we've been going through about 5 years per week, we've had loads and loads of albums to talk about. Not the case this week. It's only two to talk about. It was very nearly the first regular episode where we only have one to talk about, but another one sneaked in there. The one that sneaked in there was at the very start, which is Paul Weller with his latest 22 Dreams, which only went gold and only spent 1 week at number one. And the whole rest of this period, such as it is, it's quite short, but the whole rest of this period is taken up by Coldplay with their latest album, Viva La Vida or Death and All His Friends, which went number one for 5 consecutive weeks, and it would later return to number one as well. 5 consecutive weeks and went 5 times platinum. I had a look, because there's not much to say in this album segment, I had a look at everything else that was in the charts at this time, and it does have to be said, it was a very quiet period on the charts. Most weeks, it was Duffy with Rock Ferry just behind Coldplay, which has been number one before, but that was very popular at the time as well. The highest new entry I could find was Darren Styles with his album Skydiving, which was in the top 5 most of those weeks.
Who?
No idea. No idea. Yeah, he was a producer, and he had an album out that peaked at 3 and was in the top 5 most of those weeks, so we very nearly had an obscure Darren Styles number one there. But no, this was the summer of Viva La Vida. It was what everyone was listening to, so maybe more on that another time, eh? Oink oink.
And Lizzie, how are the states?
I only have one single to mention this week, as there's a lot of back and forth happening between previous number ones around this time. So that single is Viva La Vida by Coldplay. It was their first single to hit number one in the US and was eventually certified 5 times platinum over there. Get this, it was also the first single since 1971 to be at number one in the US and the UK simultaneously. The last single to achieve this, anyone want to guess?
Paul McCartney, something like that, don't know.
Rob, any advance?
Just because I saw it today, is it Vincent by Don McLean?
No, afraid not. You'll both know it. It's Maggie May by Rod Stewart.
Ah.
Okay. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So, over to albums, where we kick off with Here I Stand by Usher. Only 1 week, but got to number one in the UK as well. Then we have Indestructible by Disturbed. 1 week, number 20 in the UK. And finally, we have Viva La Vida or Death and All His Friends by Coldplay. 2 weeks, also got to number one over here, obviously.
All right then, thank you both very much, and we're going to press on with the first song this week. And it is this. This is Singing in the Rain by Mint Royale. Released as a standalone single, Singing in the Rain is Mint Royale's 7th single overall to be released in the UK and their first to reach number one. However, as of 2024, it is their last. The single is a remix of the song originally written by Arthur Freed in 1929. The remix actually was originally released in 2005 when it got to number 20. Singing in the Rain re-entered the chart at number 28, reaching number 1 during its second week on the chart, knocking Rihanna off the top spot. It stayed at number 1 for 2 weeks. In its first week atop the charts, it sold 47,000 copies, beating competition from Love Song by Sarah Bareilles, which climbed to number 6, and Sweet About Me by Gabriella Chilmi, which climbed to number 7. And in week 2, it sold 28,000 copies, beating competition from Forever by Chris Brown, which climbed to number 8. When it was knocked off the top of the charts, Singing in the Rain fell 7 places to number 8. By the time it was done on the charts, it had been inside the top 100 for 17 weeks. In total, the song has never received any official certification from the British phonographic industry. Kicking us off this week, Lizzie.
Yeah, I've really liked some of what I've heard this week while revisiting Mint Royale. Like, there is a lot of forgettable big beat tracks in the style of Fatboy Slim or Chemical Brothers, but there's also some really lovely sample delia pop that isn't a million miles away from what The Avalanches ended up sounding like. I'd give special mention to Falter featuring Lauren Byrne and Something New featuring Duffy 2 years before Rock Ferry. I think they're both really good tracks. As for this, I think it's a fun twist on a well-known sample combined with a really good electro riff. But I do feel that you need the visuals to really sell this. You need either the original Volkswagen Golf advert, that's why it got to number 20 in 2005, by the way, or the George Samson performance on Britain's Got Talent that it was based on and which obviously propelled it to number 1 this year. In my opinion, this works better as a short audio-visual experience rather than a longer dance track. Like, going back to Fatboy Slim, I think I kind of place this in the same ballpark as tracks like Praise You and Right Here, Right Now, which are both good songs in their own right, but I think are more well-remembered when combined with their respective videos. It's meant as a package rather than, you know, an individual sort of piece. The best version of this, I think, might actually be the short radio edit, which runs for just over 2 minutes. It gives you everything you need without running out of steam towards the end like the longer edit does. Still, I do quite like this one overall, and I think it's quite a fitting farewell to that turn of the century big beat sound. I almost see it as like an acceptance that, like Gene Kelly and Singing in the Rain, it is now part of the music of the past rather than the music of the future. Mm. And I think that's quite a sweet way to go out.
Yeah, I agree with you, Lizzie, that without the visual of either George Samson or, like you say, the original advert, it's kind of hard to review the song in isolation because it does come as a, at least in this context, it does come as a complete package with George Samson, because they connected with him and they wanted something that reminded us of him. Like, with the public, we wanted to celebrate George Samson in a way that we knew how, which was to buy this song that he danced to. And so I don't really think anybody cared about what this sounded like, so long as it sounded like George Samson dancing. And in that moment, for a couple of weeks, it did. Yeah. And looking back, it's a little hard to understand it, you know, without the context of Britain's Got Talent. I feel like, you know, future music historians, if it's not mentioned that George Samson came as a package with this song, they would go, "Ooh, what an oddity." And then they would have to look up why. You know, it's not a traditional kind of pop song that makes sense on its own. But I think aside from, how do I put this, its weaknesses when sort of not associated with other aesthetic experiences, I think it's still a solid enough remix. I'm glad you mentioned The Avalanches, because there's a thought in my head, especially towards the middle and the end, where you get the sort of deeper register, the "I'm ready for that bit, that does sound very Praise You, but also Avalanches. It's like this, you know, have you seen Blade Runner 2049?
I've not, no.
Regrettably, I have.
Oh, Andy. But there's a scene towards the sort of middle end of the movie where the characters are in Vegas, 70-odd years on from when Elvis is performing there, and there's just a hologram of Elvis on a loop in the background performing, and it's just this digital image that's just kind of, it's been playing on a loop for about 60 years. that's kind of similarly how I feel with Gene Kelly's kind of voice in the background of all this. You know, it's like a something that's echoing forwards a little bit through time. I think with remixes of classic songs like this, you always run the risk of butchering it without really putting your own stamp on it. But I think this is very, you know, recognisably a Gene Kelly remix, but it sounds very 2005. I actually thought it sounded quite similar to things like Dr. Pressure, Gloria Estefan thing, but also the Jackie Body, which coincidentally was also on a car advert in 2005, and was also back in the charts after originally being released years previous. And so, you know, there's a few connections there, and there is a little bit of context just within the pop charts itself. So I think that this is definitely worth something. I'm hardly going to be vaulting it. I haven't really been looking forward to it as I've seen it in the list for any particular reason. But I'm glad that we've managed to sort of remember George Sampson in a way, because obviously he was from round our parts.
He was.
I think, knowingly or not, the three of us may... I mean, Andy, I don't know if you came over to Manchester at all in 2007 or 2008, but me and Lizzie definitely will have, if not knowingly, seen him dancing on Market Street.
Oh, I definitely have, yeah.
And then after he won, he went back and did it, didn't he? For a little while afterwards too, and he drew big audiences. There were a few rumours around the time afterwards that, like, he injured himself and that's why he wasn't dancing much anymore, but then he seemed to reappear for a bit. He seemed kind of happy with his lot, I suppose. And yeah, he was happy to just kind of carry on dancing, doing his thing.
Well, on that note, I suppose we should mention that he did try to launch a music career. He released a double A-side, I want to say, towards the end of 2008, and one of them had quite a prominent sample on it. What was it now? Was it Everybody Dance Now?
Oh, yes. I think I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, so it's clear that this was on Simon Cowell's label. It's clear that they put quite a bit of money into this. It only got to about number 30, I think. And that was it, but they tried.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, it's fair enough, I think, with stuff like George Sampson, because music wasn't his, you know, his MO, if you will. So they gave it a shot, didn't work, and George Sampson was like, right, I'm going to happily trot on back to my life now, or bebop my way back to my life, I should say. Hey. He doesn't trot. Andy, how are we feeling about Mint Royale?
First of all, I just very quickly, because Sweet About Me by Gabriella Chilmi was mentioned, and I just very quickly want to jump in on that, because as soon as you mentioned that, I remembered one of my favourite clips from the Simon Amstel era of Nevermind the Buzzcocks, when Gabriella Chilmi was on promoting that song, and he was really teasing her about the song and said, is there really nothing sweet about you? Like, not one thing about you that's sweet? And he said, are you really such an awful bastard? And I always used to really love that.
Obviously, people who listen to the podcast, we had a break recently because I was in Florida. I was in Kissimmee, which is a sort of like a town just outside Orlando. And sort of like the main kind of supermarket in Florida is Publix, the kind of like Tesco. And I was in a Publix just buying food. And Gabriella Chilmi, Sweet About Me, was playing on the tannoy.
Good song there. Got quite a soft spot for that one. Anyway, so George Sampson, I do briefly want to mention on him that possibly the reason he disappeared is that he does actually have a disability, which really should prevent him from dancing. And he had to get some support to work through it. He's got a problem with the curvature of his spine, but he has managed to make his way through that. Good on him. Yeah. But yes, so this is an interesting one for me, this, you know, because... for one reason or another, it really took me back. Really, really took me back in time listening to this. I think one of the reasons for that is that this, more than maybe any other song we've covered on the show so far, is a flash in the pan moment in time song that is purely because it's gone big on a TV show and so it's zipped right to number one. Like, you know, songs have got to number one before because they've appeared in adverts, you know, more so back in the 80s and 90s, but this is kind of the noughties equivalent of that. And probably because it is such a specific moment in time where everyone went crazy for this song for a couple of weeks, it just had a huge nostalgic effect on me, more than I expected, to be honest. Briefly, you know, looking at why this took off, the context of it, I do think that for George Sampson, this is a really kind of great choice of song for this, because it's kind of a combination of old whimsy with modern cool, really. So you kind of get that kind of pull at the heartstrings. Ah, oh, look at the boy dancing to musical theatre. But you also get, he's actually quite cool. Like, I kind of want to be mates with him. So he manages to straddle both lines really well and kind of won the public's hearts with that. And I do want to say on that as well that as much as, you know, the Simon Cowell shows are not the nicest thing in the world, and you would really kind of fear for a child on that show, it's genuinely a pretty sweet story, to be honest, that, you know, this kid who's very talented at dancing has, you know, worked bloody hard at it. He got kicked out on the first series of Britain's Got Talent, and then he came back and auditioned again. And because of that talent, has won the show and he's made a career out of it. Kind of hard not to be a little bit moved by it, to be honest, because as much as those shows are all corporate and blah, 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 you know, he is a kid at the end of the day who's been given a massive platform and has, you know, made a career out of it. Hard not to be a little bit touched by that and hard not to be very happy for him. And it was a very feel-good moment in TV, really, and it's no surprise that everybody, including myself, immediately rushed to iTunes and downloaded that song right after, because it just fit the bill perfectly. As a song, I do kind of like that combo of the Singing in the Rain sample with the modern stuff, but it's much more reliant on new stuff than it is on Singing in the Rain, to be honest. It's a little bit of a novelty that includes that. If you look at the actual amount of Singing in the Rain that it takes and puts into this, it's very little. It's only really about 20 seconds worth of it that makes it in, and it's mainly just that refrain of do-do-do-do-do-do. It's mainly just that. So it's a little bit of a gimmick, but it is still fun. I don't have a huge amount to say about the song, to be honest, except that I do like that combo. It kind of reminds me of some other more early noughties stuff that I really like the remix of 19-2000 by Gorillaz, which is just like, I love that. I love that so much. It's just kind of really easy to listen to and really fun. But mainly, I just kind of was struck by how much this took me back in time and how much this put me back in the shoes of myself in 2008, where the start of 2008 was like an awful time for me, and I don't like to look back on it at all. But the summer, it was really nice to revisit that. I was just like, I remember watching that final in the summer of 2008, and then right afterwards flipping over and seeing David Tennant and Catherine Tate fighting Sontarans through time and space, and then going out into Ormskirk with my friends to sit in a park until midnight like a bunch of homeless people. It's just a lovely, lovely time to revisit for me, and it was very nice. I just left school, so it was kind of like the world was my oyster. And that was how it was with George Sampson as well. The kind of world was his oyster in this moment. So it's just a nice thing to look back on for me. As for the song itself, like I said, I think it's a cool remix. It's quite gimmicky. It's quite sort of throwaway, to be honest, but it was nice to hear it again. But mainly just a very pleasant thing to revisit. Pleasant to sort of reflect on the success that this gave to George Sampson, who is still doing really well. He's in LA and everybody's talking about Jamie. He's still doing really well. And just a nice time in my life to look back on as well. So yeah, I'm very glad this came along. Yeah, it's just fine as a piece of music, but I'm really glad it came along. Yeah,
yeah. I've forgotten about his brief acting career as well, because he'd been in Waterloo Road. I think he was in Emmerdale for about a year. I mean,
not brief. That's his job. That's what he's been doing. Like since the early tens, he's been in theatre basically the whole time. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I meant more TV acting. That seems to have kind of slowed down. Apparently, he reappeared on Britain's Got Talent, The Champions.
He did.
As himself, which I don't really remember, but I don't really remember much of 2019 for reasons we'll explore when we get there. Okay, so on to the second song this week, which is just a little thing. It's this.
Streets I used to own.
This is Viva La Vida by Coldplay. Released as the second single from the band's fourth studio album, titled Viva La Vida or Death and All His Friends, Viva La Vida is Coldplay's 13th single overall to be released in the UK and their first to reach number one. It's not the last time that we'll be coming to Coldplay on this podcast. Viva La Vida went straight in at number one as a brand new entry, knocking Mint Royale off the top of the charts. It stayed at number one for 1 week. In its first and only week atop the charts, it sold 23,000 copies, beating competition from No Air by Jordan Sparks, which climbed to number 10. When it was knocked off the top of the charts, Viva La Vida dropped one place to number two. It initially left the top 100 in June 2009. But it re-entered the chart in 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013, 2017, 2023, and is currently at number 88 in the UK chart in April 2024. At present, the song has been inside the top 100 for 118 weeks. And it is currently officially certified 5 times platinum, so quintuple platinum, in the UK as of 2024. In terms of the songs we have covered on this podcast thus far, it has sold the most and has been in the chart for the longest. So, Andy, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, those are some stats there. But it's... You know, obviously what comes through in those stats there is that this was a grower. And that's how I remember it, is that it is the definition of one that really, really grew. I actually remember, it may not have been the first time it was mentioned to me, but the first time I remember it being mentioned to me was, it was probably long after it had been number one, because it would, you know, it only sold 23,000. It wasn't that big a hit. And I remember my dad mentioned to me, he said, oh, I hope that it could be in the car. He said, I hope that new Coldplay one comes on. I really like it. Have you heard that Coldplay song? And, you know, I was a bit like, all right, Dad, you know, you know the way, like, Bart and Lisa treat Homer in that episode of The Simpsons, Homer-palooza? Yeah. It's like, where do I get the latest releases by Bread? You know, I kind of treated it a bit like that, like, it's probably not good, is it? But then some of my friends at school were also like, have you heard that new Coldplay song? It's really, like, interesting. Like, it's really good, actually. And Coldplay were not cool. Like, really not. They were, you know, really kind of down there with Katie Melua in terms of street cred in my school. But people like were kind of begrudgingly like, oh, this is quite good, actually. And then when it came on, I was like, oh, okay, I see what the fuss is about here. Because it's very, very different. Not just for them, because it is different for them, but also just in the landscape. This is something quite fresh, quite new. And certainly has a bit of a sound world that is different to a lot of what's been number one so far, but also lyrically is very different as well. I'm never quite sure how I feel about these arty-farty lyrics about St. Peter and old mythology and Roman cavalry choirs and stuff, because, you know, it's a little bit wanky, really, isn't it? It's a little bit pretentious, but I kind of say that with retrospect. I kind of say that with, like, you know, so many other groups and so many other acts have done that now. I think of, like, Pompeii by Bastille and stuff, where it's, like, it's a bit old. It's a bit old hat now to reference, like, Roman empires and stuff. But it wasn't then. Like, it was a different take then. It was a different sort of thing to put in pop music then. And it's just, it's worn very thin as the years have gone by. So I kind of don't want to punish Coldplay too much for that. The problem that I have with this is the problem that I have with every Coldplay song, which is Chris Martin's voice. this is going to be like the shadiest comment ever, but it's genuinely how I feel, is that I feel all of Coldplay's success is in spite of Chris Martin rather than because of him, to be honest. I think there are very few songs of theirs that his voice actually suits, and I think it's quite a testament to their songwriting that they've managed to rise above his thin, whiny voice, to be honest. Especially live. I've never understood why they're such a big live act, because his voice live is atrocious. Mm. Atrocious. One of the worst live voices I have ever heard. And this is one of the few songs where it kind of works. It kind of works. Fix You is the other one where I think that kind of thin, vulnerable sound kind of suits it. I do think it suits it. Like, I don't really like Fix You that much, but I do think that that thin, kind of vulnerable thing suits that song. And yeah, it's kind of okay with this, but God, his voice is hard to listen to. There's just something so grating about it, which I can't put my finger on what it is. A little bit like James Blunt's voice, to be honest. But yes, musically, I really, really like this. Again, something that's old hat now, but was not then, is this string thing, which kind of sounds like the Vitamin String Quartet sort of thing, really, that would get so big through the next decade. Again, old hat now, because you've got stuff like Rather Be, with that violin intro and all sorts of other things that use kind of string intros and string back in through, all the way through now. But again, quite revolutionary at the time. And I can remember how big a deal this was in terms of, whoa, this is different. This is something that's like got a lot of new ideas about it. Very catchy, at least that bit, very much that caught on at least. It's just a very good song, to be honest. I don't think it's perfect. Like I say, I'd rather almost anyone else was singing it than Chris Martin. And I do think the lyrics do border on the indulgent and the look how many books I've read kind of thing. You know, I do think it borders on indulgent to a degree that's not good, to be honest. But overall, I actually really like this. It's still to this day, I don't like Coldplay. Like, I just don't like them. But I kind of have to give this credit, to be honest. And I can see why it stuck around for so many years, because it is one of those songs that you kind of discover. I imagine the kids have kind of discovered this. You know, they've looked back on this as a song, like, of our generation, and they've been like, ooh, yeah. I don't think it'll ever really go away, to be honest, which is the highest compliment I can give it. I don't think it's, like, the greatest song that's ever existed, but it's definitely the biggest stamp the Coldplay I've ever put on the charts, and it is pretty good. It's pretty good, yeah.
For a lot of reasons, good and bad, I really think that Viva La Vida is the single most influential and probably important song we've ever covered on the podcast, and I say that because I think its blueprint is plastered all over the next decade. This is the 2010s kind of coming into view now. I think that not only does this turn Coldplay from one of the biggest bands in Britain to being probably the biggest band in the world. I mean, they're at number one in the US as well. And it sets up their success for the next few album cycles as more of a kind of like an electro-y, pop-rocky concern. You know, it has huge ripple effects on all the dominant pop music strands of the 2010s, especially the EDM movement, the millennial whoop, as they called it. You know, choruses no longer containing lyrics or hooks, just kind of being these kind of like sweeping instrumental passages. Pop rock bands like The Killers and Maroon 5 and One Republic looking at the success of Coldplay and deciding to drop their guitars and buy keyboards and do stringy stuff instead. Music producers thinking that these long instrumental sections always conjure up catharsis, regardless of where you place them in the song. And to laboriously prove this point, I'm going to point it out every time we come across a song where you hear Viva La Vida somewhere in the distance. Because this, I'm glad you mentioned it first, Andy, because this feels like the origin point for Bastille. It feels like the origin point for Imagine Dragons. It feels like the origin point for what Mumford & Sons eventually pivoted to after two albums. But even stuff like Swedish House Mafia, I think it points towards a future where in pop music where everything is fuchsia and glittery paint, and music festivals become places for normies to hang out rather than society's freaks. I think this is precise. This precise moment on the map is the beginning of the 2010s, for better or worse, which means that it's kind of hard to discuss Viva La Vida in isolation. So I tried my hardest. Because the thing is, over the years, I have blamed Viva La Vida for a lot of stuff that isn't really its fault. You know, I think this is the weakest song on Coldplay's strongest album. But just in the context of 2008, in isolation, I think this is Coldplay arriving at a point where they've spent the last three albums kind of navigating their path out of clubs and pubs towards stadiums and, you know, big arena-sized pop rock stuff. You know, X and Y, in my opinion, suffered a little bit from the transition, I think. That is a transitional record in every sense of the word. But for this album, they get in Brian Eno, who helped U2 expertly through a similar phase in their career 20 years before this. And they get John Hopkins in as well, who was a curious name to see among the credits. He becomes a much bigger deal in alternative dance circles around 5 years from this point. And I think the album, Viva La Vida, it's a colourful, spirited, focused pop record that finds Coldplay really bringing to life something that I think they kind of fumbled on X and Y, to be honest. I remember being taken to the tour for this in 2009 when they toured with Jay-Z, and it was a good show. I think, you know, on that tour they kind of made the leap from a band with a huge following to just kind of a universally popular group. And Andy, I was trying to, you know, think before when you were mentioning, you know, you're not a fan of Chris Martin's voice. I'm fine with it. I don't really have any intense like or dislike for it. But I think as a production band, Coldplay are very, very good. And that's why their
shows are, you know, that's why
they get so many people to go and look at their stage productions and their shows and stuff like that. They know how to fill a large space, if you know what I mean. I don't like all of their music, but they know how to fill a large space. So fair play to them for that. And I think that making this kind of transition into universal popularity, this is the kind of ideal single to do it with. It's a shame it wasn't Violet Hill, and that Violet Hill wasn't as influential as this, because that sounds more like Elbow than anything else that Coldplay have done. But this is big, and it's fist-pumpy, and it's got, like, big driving rhythms everywhere. Like, absolutely everything about its arrangement pushes and strains to drive it only forwards and upwards. You know, that kind of, the string quartet, it's nicely kind of syncopated against the backbeat, but its only thoughts are forwards. Nothing ever slows down in this. And if it is going to slow down ever so slightly or be more sparse, it goes up to compensate for that. Lyrically, I think it's a curious and unusual thing. You know, how often do we get pop songs about someone observing their fallen empire, realizing that they're not going to heaven? Kind of like an Ozymandias thing, you know, it's quite weighty subject matter, but they managed to boil it down and make it accessible and memorable. And then by the time you reach the bit, which is mostly, I think the actual origin point is probably Wake Up by Arcade Fire, in terms of what Chris Martin was probably listening to. It does feel like a cathartic release. It's just a shame that literally every pop songwriter and producer for the next decade thinks that, oh, if we do this in the first third of the song, it will have the same impact. No, it fucking doesn't. And unfortunately, over time, I think this has kind of gone the way of Bohemian Rhapsody or Mr. Brightside or Don't Look Back in Anger, where it's not really a song with individual parts anymore. It's just a universally accepted, familiar noise that doesn't really evoke a specific feeling anymore. It's just, oh yeah, that. And I always think the worst thing that can possibly happen to a song is for it to stop being a mystery, where society understands it too well. It's been observed and overplayed and picked at to the point where it's impossible to get much out of it anymore. It's never sounded like a song I could personally connect to on any level that's important or intimate. I think it's always sounded a bit too expensive to me, but that's stuff that's been piled on afterwards, and that's not necessarily the song's fault. I think it's solid. I think it does kind of tower over the rest of the decade, which at least, you know, like, it, in terms of just the song on its own, good feat. Well done, everybody involved. And to their credit, Coldplay do deserve a cookie for kind of setting the template for everything going forward, even if I hate it. But Lizzie, how about you? How are we feeling on Viva La Vida?
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head there, particularly the thing about how it stops kind of being a pop song and it just becomes like an anthem. It becomes like God Save the Queen, like blasting out of the telly while it goes to bed, but you're still wide awake. It's sort of just nothing. It's noise. Like, And yeah, like you, I wish I could kind of go back and listen to it completely out of that context, because I did like this in 2008. Like you, Andy, I was kind of surrounded by people who weren't really into Coldplay, but like, yeah, the new one's not too bad. And I still think it's one of their better singles, especially from the first decade, where they were clearly more fond of those slow, reflective ballads like Fix You, The Scientist, In My Place. Even some of the more up-tempo tracks from their early years, like Clocks or Speed of Sound, they always felt to me like they were lacking something to keep the energy up. So they just kind of meandered for a few minutes and resolved with a bit of a shrug. This one has no problem sustaining that energy all the way through. There is a sense of building tension that runs throughout, that culminates in that wordless bridge, the whoa, that, like you say, seems to have formed the basis for so many pop choruses of the 2010s. And yeah, like I totally agree with you, Rob. The lyrics are very unusual. It's, again, how often do you hear about songs about like a fallen empire and a sort of king who's been left desolate, I guess. I think maybe it is just a metaphor for I'm having a bit of a rough time. I went to Sainsbury's, I didn't take an umbrella. But, yeah, I think there's something there to be able to work that into a pop hit without sort of, you know, confusing people. Sometimes it can be the case that you hear a song like that on the radio, you think, what the hell is this? But it obviously works because the overall sound of it is anthemic. It is stirring, and at least out of context, if you kind of forget about everything that's come afterwards, in the right context, it can be quite affecting, even. Certainly more so to me than any of their previous stuff, which, you know, like Fix You, I just find it so boring, and I think it brings out the worst in Chris Martin's vocal in particular, because he really tries to stretch, he really tries to push his voice right up to the tippity top, and it sounds crap. He doesn't do that as much here. He's sort of, it's a bit more grounded. And as such, yeah, I think I've waffled a bit there, but genuinely, I do think it is one of their better singles. Just not something, probably not something I'll vault, but yeah, out of context, pretty good. In the context of everything that came after it, I never want to hear it again.
You know, in terms of the lyrics, in terms of like, oh, how do you relate to it? Like, how do you get that feeling of what this actually means? I do think the line that makes it work is the, but that was when I ruled the world. I think that can just click of like, oh, but you know, that was when things were better. That's what makes it relatable. That's what makes it click. I think if it wasn't for that line, I think it would be really quite impenetrable, but that line makes it work.
Yeah, it's the pain of nostalgia. I think most people can relate to.
Yeah. I just wanted to come in as well on the point about, you know, the wordless choruses. I do take your point, Rob, about like this is definitely a point where it blows up exponentially, and I definitely don't disagree with that. I do think it goes back quite a lot further, though, really. Like, it's definitely been attempted in this kind of form before. As much as it's, like, crap, I do think there are quite a lot of similarities to the Earth song, to be honest, that has a wordless chorus and is extremely weighty over-the-top topics as well. And I was thinking, what's the actual genesis point of, like, you know, just oh, 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 or ah, 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 or na, na, na. And honestly, Hey Jude is probably the absolute Big Bang moment for that kind of thing.
Maybe, but that's more of a coda section.
You know what it is?
But it's the bit that everybody knows.
Yeah.
I've just figured it out. It's Tarzan Boy by Baltimora.
Oh, I mean, that is just a wonderful song. And actually, yeah, that's actually not too far off. Yeah, so like it has been there through the decades, but this is the point at which, for some reason, it really, really clicks and blows up, and there's no doubt about that. But I do think this tracks back quite a lot further, really. I'd be interested to do more of a deep dive on that, on the wordless chorus, because, why does it blow up so much here?
I mean, we nearly had another one this year with Use Somebody by Kings of Leon. That's an awful song.
Oh, joy.
Thank God we avoided that.
I never ever thought in my life I would be in a position where I was grateful for Sex on Fire instead.
Genuinely.
Just to give my early thoughts on that one. Okay, our final song this week is this.
She shines just like a star, and I swear I know her face. I just don't know who you are. Turn the music up in here, I still hear her loud and clear, like she's right there in my ear, telling me that she wants to own me, to control.
Right, this is Closer by Neo. Released as the lead single from his third studio album titled Year of the Gentleman, Closer is Neo's eighth single overall to be released in the UK and his second to reach number one, and it isn't the last time that we'll be coming to Neo on this podcast. Closer first entered the UK chart at number 22, reaching number one during its eighth week on the chart, knocking Coldplay off the top spot. It stayed at number one for 1 week. In its first and only week atop the charts, it sold 31,000 copies, beating competition from We Made It by Busta Rhymes and Linkin Park, which climbed to number 10. Is that the only climber in the top 10? I mean, it's not bad, but just who remembers that? When it was knocked off the top of the charts, Closer fell one place to number 2. By the time it was done on the charts, it had been inside the top 100 for 39 weeks. The song is currently officially certified platinum in the UK as of 2024. These stats are kind of more in keeping, I think, with earlier years. Like, it kind of becomes standard on this podcast, you know. 30-odd weeks, platinum, that's fine. It's not the numbers of Viva La Vida. I feel less in awe of this and less daunted by it. Lizzie, Neo, how are we feeling?
Just before I go into the song, I heard a great term for the sort of singles that take a little while to get to number one. Someone described them as a chart tipper.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I'll leave that in your head. Anyway, it was only in the last episode that I mentioned how much Neo's songwriting had improved since So Sick in 2006, and I think this is another example of that. I think this is significantly better than So Sick. And yeah, I'd go as far as to say better even than Take a Bow from last week, which I also really liked. I love how this one straddles a line between romantic and tense, halfway between like an R&B ballad and a club banger. The beat changes in this keep you on your toes, adding to the sense of unpredictability that the lyrics convey. Like Take a Bow last week, it's a sort of songwriting that I'd describe as clever. There's a way that Neo could have written and produced this that would have produced a pretty decent ballad, but certain choices in the production and the pacing of the track elevate this to something quite special, I think. I do have a small gripe about the mixing. Overall, I think the mix sounds a bit too flat, but the drum beat in particular is a bit too prominent. So as a result, some elements, like the layered harmonies in the chorus, don't stand out the way they should, which is a shame. And it's all the more frustrating because Neo clearly has a fantastic voice, and I'm glad he kept this one for himself rather than offering it up to someone like Rihanna. He really sells that sense of desperation in the lyrics, and I think it's what makes this track so compelling overall. I'm a really big fan of this.
Yeah, this is interesting for me because I've been interested to hear, you know, what you both might have to say about this, because I feel like I'm sort of missing something a little bit with this, where I like it. It's a decent pop song, but I don't really think it's anything special. I think part of what makes me feel that way is, I'm glad you mentioned about the drums, Lizzie, because I do have a problem with the mix, that too much drums, not enough bass, which is a bit of a weird thing, really. It makes it feel quite light in a way that I don't really... Yeah. It shouldn't really be, given what it's going for and what the subject matter is and the idea and the tension that should be in the song. It's weird for it to be light in that way. So, I don't know. I think this is just part of... I've gone on about this so many times about problems in mixing in this era, and I think it's just... It's made for mobile phones, basically, which, fair enough, I get it. I get where they're coming from with that. I do like when a song really commits to an idea, where it just, like, strains at that idea, which is the whole closer thing all the way through. Completely agree that this is a big improvement on So Sick, and definitely improving as a songwriter. This is much more of a confident song, this. Much more of an overall pop package, really, that it has that drive to it. It definitely has so many catchy elements to it as well. But it doesn't quite, like, rise to the very top for me. I don't know what it is. I just don't think it's particularly standout or special. But this, again, it might be in retrospect, because there are a lot of copycats to this sort of thing. From Neo himself as well. Like, there are a lot of different kind of takes on this sort of thing over the next few years.
Oh, definitely.
So it might just be, you know, the opposite of rose-tinted glasses, really, which is affecting this. My main memory of this song, by the way, is the 2010 World Cup coverage. They had a montage of the German player, I think he was German, Miroslav Klose to this, which I thought was it. Genius. Someone in the editing suite deserved a raise for that one. But yes, I do like this, and it's instantly recognisable. I it's one of those ones where I kind of forgot about it, but then I was like, how could I forget about this? Like, this is a huge hit. And it serves the purpose very well. It's a very confidently written song. I have no particular problem with it, but I also don't think it's like the bee's knees either. For me, it's just kind of fine. And I can't put my finger on what more I need from it, other than a bit more of an all-round meatier sound, and I all I can think of is that's what it is, that's what I need from it. But just to be absolutely clear, I do really like this. I do think it's pretty good. I just don't think it's great, and I don't think it's as good as Viva La Vida, and I don't think it's as good as Take a Bow, unfortunately. Yeah.
With regards to Miroslav Klose, there's a rather brilliant stat about him, Andy. Do you know what that stat could be?
No. Huh?
Did he take 8 weeks to get to number one?
Well, not quite, but he is at number one in something. He is the player to have scored the most goals at World Cup finals. He has scored 16 goals across four World Cup
Bloody
tournaments
hell.
From between 2002 and 2014, winning it once. Yes, Closer Neo as opposed to Miroslav. I never thought I would ever discuss Miroslav Closer on this podcast. Thank you.
Happy to help.
I agree with you both on the production being slightly flat. That is my mark against the song. But the song itself, I love this, basically for the same reason that I love American Boy. I think it is sleek and sophisticated and smooth and very, very infectious. I think that as much as So Sick prioritize Neo's voice, and this kind of prioritizes vibe over vocals, if you will, I think this is his best vocal performance, because he's moving at quite a pace here, and he shows amazing control over the whole thing. I actually think it has quite a lot in common with some UK garage stuff. In the verses, I'm reminded of Craig David, especially with the acoustic guitar just kind of decorating gently, in the background.
I do like that, by the way. I forgot to mention that, but I like that little touch, yeah. And I see what you mean with that garage connection, yeah.
But do you know who it really reminds me of, and who should be doing stuff like this, and instead he's releasing some of the worst pop music I've ever heard in my life right now? Usher. Usher should be doing this kind of stuff right now, but he's not. He's doing Love in This Club, which, oh my God. Because as much as this reminds me of Craig David stuff, it reminds me of Caught Up from Confessions, which is sadly a song that didn't get to number one, but it is my favourite single of the selection that Usher released from that album. I think Neo carries the aesthetics over from something like that. The smart suit and the trilby, the modern R&B touches and flavours, the dance moves, the all-male dance troupe wearing suit and tie. You know, that it's very, very reminiscent of that. But a lot like American Boy, as much as it has an eye on that, you know, very recent past, it has that eye on the future. I think we will come to a lot of songs in the future who try this kind of stuff without the same kind of class or restraint. We may not come to them in full detail because they get to number one, but they will at least be mentioned in passing during, like, the stats bit at the start of each segment. Because I do think that this is another song that kind of, again, I can see the 2010s. I mean, this kind of more sets a template that's a little bit more short term. I feel like this sets a template for over the next 2 or 3 years, as opposed to the next 10 years. Because I think with Coldplay, they also kind of get reinforced with I'm Not Alone by Calvin Harris, which is another kind of everybody tries to do that for a while as well. Neo's Closer didn't quite have that second song kind of backing it up to make people realize, oh, we can combine this thing and this thing to make this thing. I feel like not a lot of people learned a lesson from this, which is a bit of a shame, because even Neo, like, I think this is the last song we're going to cover involving Neo that, like, I like, because he just attaches himself to, he leaves all of this stuff behind, and he just attaches himself to this coming wave of, oh god, just like Pitbull and Beautiful Monster and all those songs that we're going to have to do. But for this moment in time, I think he really reaches a good kind of peak here. I don't think I've ever listened to Year of the Gentleman in full. Maybe I will seek this out. But I do like this one. I think that amongst quite sort of serious songs we've had recently, you know, with Viva La Vida, Take a Bow as well, which we only touched on just last week. Mercy, I suppose, as well, as quite a serious one. 4 Minutes was all very serious, you know. This is just kind of like, yeah, it is fun. Pop is fun. You know, that kind of nice balance, that kind of nice reminder. I will say that, obviously, I think this is the last episode of 2008 and the last episode for a long time where I will be happy with everything in it to a degree.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a coincidence that I turned 14 while these songs were at number one. I do think my age and tastes at the time have more to do with it. But, yeah, I'm not going to be... It's going to be a while before we come across another episode where I'm like... There might be one in 2009, actually, now I mention it. But apart from that, I think it will be... There will be at least one song each week where I'm like, eh. And then every other week I've been fairly kind with regards to pie-holing stuff. I feel like we've had a lot of occasions where you two have, like, you know, gone like, no, I have to pie-hole this because of this, and I've been kind of less sure-footed at the kind of negative ends of my opinions, but not from this point on, to be honest. Does anybody else have anything more to say about the songs this week before we check whether we're going to vault or pie-hole anything?
There's one episode in 2009 which I think is great, but yeah, we're in for a rough period, let's just say.
Yeah, hopefully we'll
stay tuned, folks.
Yes, please stay tuned. Don't give up on us when we're miserable. Andy, Mint Royale, Coldplay, Neo, how are we feeling?
Well, Mint Royale was good, but I don't think it was mint. So it's not going in the vault or the pie hole. As for Viva La Vida, I've been umming and ahhing about whether it should actually be Viva La Vault. And it's going to be. Yeah, what the hell, do it. I'll put it in the vault. It's certainly going to be the only time I vault Coldplay, so let's do it. Yeah. And as for Neo, It's knee no, as far as I'm concerned. No, it's not going in either. Not going in either the vault. Sorry. It's not going in either the vault or the pie hole. I had worse puns than that, and I settled on knee no, so be grateful for small mercies, you two.
Oh, no, Andy, if I could vault your puns this week, definitely. Lizzie, Singing in the Rain, Viva La Vida, and Closer.
Singing in the Rain will be singing in neither the vault nor the pie hole. It's going nowhere.
Singing in the middle.
Viva La Vida, it may have ruled the world, but it will not rule either the vault or the pie hole. It's going nowhere for me. And Closer, come closer, into the vault. I'm putting it in.
Excellent stuff. Singing in the Rain... Yep, that's going absolutely nowhere for me. So it's raining in between the pie hole and the vault, unfortunately. Lots of songs getting drenched right now. Viva La Vida, that is just missing the vault. Just. Yeah, St. Peter won't call its name, and I'm not calling its name either. And Closer, well, Andy, you said knee no, but it's knee yes for me. It's going in the vault. Definitely going in the vault for Closer. Glad that we got to that one.
I'm just giggling about how he said, oh, St. Peter didn't call its name, but I will. Which really kind of made it seem like St. Peter was a panellist on our show. Which, to my knowledge, he never has been. But yeah.
If you're listening. That is it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. When we come back, we'll be continuing our journey through 2008. We will see you for it. Bye-bye now.
See ya.
Bye-bye.